The headlines: Lebanon's Hezbollah chief warns that Israel's continued aggression against the Al-Aqsa Mosque could result in a regional flare-up. Iran urging the UN to officially condemn the recent assassination of a member of its armed forces, as a new report by New York Times says Israel was behind the killing. Iran blames U.S. failure to make political decisions for stalled talks on the revival of the 2015 deal as Washington threatens to step up sanctions. Hello and welcome, everybody. Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement hails the victory over Israel in the year 2000, saying it was an unprecedented achievement for the resistance. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah was delivering an address marking the 22nd anniversary of the liberation of southern Lebanon from the Israeli occupation. He said the victory thwarted the regime's project for creating Greater Israel. The Hezbollah leader said Israel is a barbaric entity that only pretends to be civilized. Nasrallah said Hezbollah has been fighting to protect Lebanon and its people without having any intention to grab power. The Hezbollah leader added that the resistance movement does not seek permission from anyone to protect the country. He also warned Israel about continuation of its aggression against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Nasrallah said any aggression against Al-Aqsa and other sanctities of Muslims will cause an explosion in the region. Lebanon marks the Resistance and Liberation Day on May 25th every year. Hezbollah forces drove out Israel from southern Lebanon in May 2000, ending over two decades of the regime's occupation. From Beirut, our correspondent Mariam Saleh tells us about the long way the Lebanese government has come in its resistance against the Israeli occupation.
We saw that in the speech, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah has also stressed that now the resistance is stronger than it had been in 1982. Of course, it was just in the beginning. It had humble capabilities, and still it began its resistance operations along with other factions as well, which Sayed Nasrallah acknowledged. But of course, what he also said was that the reason why the resistance has gained strength is, of course, because it does have support from countries like Syria and the Islamic Republic of Iran. It does have the support of its people. It does have faith, but what's most important is that it has given a lot of sacrifices, including the sacrifices of the martyrs of leaders like Sayed Abbas Mousavi, whom you mentioned. And he said that this is one of the points of strength, which is found in the resistance groups generally in Lebanon and in Palestine, where many leaders are martyred. That in itself has given a lot of intensified if you want strength and spirit for the people. And if I can just mention that in Lebanon, after the assassination of Sayed Abbas Mousavi, it was the first time that Hezbollah used rockets when the Israelis launched an attack right after the assassination. Therefore, thinking that perhaps the resistance is weaker, and that was the first time that Hezbollah actually used rockets, Katyusha rockets, against the Israelis.
Iran is demanding an official condemnation from the United Nations over the assassination of a member of its armed forces a few days ago. Colonel Hassan Sayed Khodai, a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, was shot dead outside his home in Tehran on Sunday, and now Iran's UN ambassador has sent a letter to UN Chief Antonio Guterres, urging the world body to denounce the killing as part of its responsibility in the fight against terrorism. Majid Tahtar Al-Anshi says certain regimes are seeking to advance their agendas with the systematic assassination of Iranian citizens and scientists. He says such state-sponsored terrorism is openly challenging the rule of law, and an international silence will only embolden the perpetrators. Based on U.S. media reports, Israel has informed U.S. officials that it was behind the killing. Israel's footsteps have already been traced in a number of attacks on Iranian nuclear sites and the assassination of its scientists. Talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal remained stalled over what Tehran calls Washington's failure to make political decisions. Now the U.S. has threatened to tighten sanctions on Iran if the deal is not restored. U.S. Special Envoy for Iran Robert Malley issued the threat during a congressional testimony. He said the prospects of reviving the accord are at best tenuous. He said the White House will continue to reject what it considers unreasonable demands from Iran. Meanwhile, the U.S. Treasury Department announced fresh sanctions on some individuals and entities For being linked to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the department claimed the IRGC leads an international oil smuggling and money laundering network. Iran has reiterated that the JCPOA revival hinges on the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington will not exit the deal again as it did in 2018. Ukraine's foreign minister accuses NATO of, quote, doing literally nothing in the face of Russia's military operation while praising EU's backing for Kiev. Dmytro Kuleba said NATO is completely sidelined and does nothing to help Ukraine in its war with Russia. Kuleba, however, praised the EU for taking what he called revolutionary and groundbreaking decisions against Russia. Ukraine has been complaining over NATO's indecisive position on Kiev's accession to the military alliance. Russia strongly opposes Ukraine's membership in NATO. The EU has imposed a barrage of sanctions against Moscow since the war in Ukraine started. EU member states are now mulling an oil embargo against Russia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky dismisses suggestions that his country should give up their territory and make concessions to end the war with Russia. Zelensky made the angry remarks in a video address to the World Economic Forum in Davos. He was reacting to a suggestion by former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger that Ukraine should let Russia keep Crimea, which it annexed in 2014. The New York Times editorial board also said last week that Ukraine might have to make, quote, hard decisions to pave the way for a negotiated peace. Zelensky dismissed both suggestions, saying negotiations for a peace deal cannot resume until Russia withdraws its troops. Zelensky has said that he would only discuss an end to hostilities with Russian President Vladimir Putin and not via intermediaries. Well, Ukrainian far-right military regiment hit the headlines after Russia launched its military operation in the country. Our correspondent in Mariupol, Johnny Miller, tells us how the extremist group is engaged in the Ukrainian conflict.
The notorious Azov Battalion, officially part of Ukraine's National Guard, their neo-Nazi roots are well documented, as are many of their crimes before the war started, such as the use of torture. Nazi-affiliated insignia remains a common sight on their clothing. Their base was in Mariupol, overlooking the Sea of Azov. They defended it fiercely against the Russians, but lost. Amongst the ruins, some anti-Azov graffiti. It reads, "Death to Fascism." And some more graffiti, perhaps written by an Azov member. It sums up their ideology. Life is slowly returning to the city, but people here will live with what they saw for the rest of their lives.
Yes, I witnessed Azov killing civilians. It was in Kurchatov Street. They were shooting from there, shelling blocks of flats, private houses, everywhere.
Each had three bazookas and a machine gun, and they started shooting. I can't say where they were shooting, because they locked us in the basement and warned if we attempted to leave, they would shoot us in the head. So we sat in the basement. The walls were shaking, and they were firing with everything, with those American javelins as well.
Ask anyone in Mariupol who was here during the fighting, and they will likely tell you stories like these, of Azov targeting civilian houses, and of the use of hostages and human shields.
It's striking that everybody I've spoken to today here in Mariupol has no criticism of the Ukrainian army, who treated them well, gave them food, helped them evacuate, but that it's Azov, the Azov battalion, who mistreated them, using them as human shields and shooting them, targeting them.
The Ukrainian military have an aim to defend civilians, and they do it. But Azov ignore these rules, and they humiliate people in different ways. Once I saw them pull two women from the streets and drive off somewhere.
This is Konstantin Ivachenko, the new mayor of Mariupol.
We are finding traces of their crimes gradually. In the area of Mariupol airport, there are brutal places. There was a prison called the Library, and all people who disagreed with the neo-Nazi point of view were tortured there.
Have you found any NATO weapons with Azov? Is there evidence that NATO has been arming Azov?
Yes, sure. We found stingers and javelins. After the city is reconstructed, we will put them on show. We have a lot of them, lots of javelins.
While thousands of Azov members have either been killed or have surrendered in Mariupol, they remain a powerful influence in Ukraine, not least because unlike many Ukrainian soldiers, they are ideologically driven to fight the Russians. As NATO weapons flood the country, many of them will find their way into the hands of extremists. Johnny Miller of Mariupol.
A report into lockdown breaching UK government parties has blamed top officials for what it calls a culture of rule-breaking in Prime Minister Boris Johnson's office. A long-awaited report by senior civil servant Sue Gray is an update on her earlier report months ago that said parties had taken place under the Prime Minister's roof. Sidepoot is a report from London.
It took months to prepare, but it's finally here. Civil servant Sue Gray's report into allegations of rule-breaking parties under the British Prime Minister's roof during pandemic lockdowns. A report Boris Johnson repeatedly told Britons would be a moment of truth.
It's really quite damning because it demonstrates this culture of booziness right at the heart of government, particularly at a time when the rest of the country was in extremis, being locked down. People were dying and not being able to see their relations.
Only a day earlier, revelations the Prime Minister met with Sue Gray at the beginning of the month, allegedly to try and change her mind about publishing her report. And before that, a police investigation that handed him, Chancellor Rishi Sunak, and several others a penalty. The report that blames top officials for breaking lockdown rules also comes in the wake of new photos of the PM toasting his departing head of communications during the second national lockdown, pictures that to many crossed the line. Soon after the report was published, a seemingly repentant Boris Johnson, who had initially told Parliament no rules had been broken, faced the wrath of the MPs.
Well, people stayed at home to protect the NHS. The Prime Minister was engaging in drinking and debauchery that makes a mockery of the gut-wrenching sacrifices that each and every person made. Will the Prime Minister now take the opportunity and resign?
As much as the Prime Minister hopes the country would move on from Partygate, experts say Gray's conclusions could revive calls from Conservative MPs for a no-confidence vote in him. If he lost such a vote, he would lose his job.
Many of his own backbenchers, including Mark Harper, have come out to say that he is not leading as one should lead. He is not setting the kind of example, indeed, the country needs. If the country is in a time of war, this is not the kind of example that will inspire people to follow him as a leader.
Boris Johnson has clung onto power partly because of the Russian military intervention in Ukraine that diverted political and public attention here. And he plans on keeping it that way by expediting a relief package to help vulnerable Britons through the cost of living crisis. Now, whether or not that will help him survive politically is a matter of wait and see. Saeed Pariza, London.
Concerns are growing worldwide over what could be the next global health scare, with an increase in the number of monkeypox cases in non-endemic countries. The confirmed infections have now passed 200. According to the European Union Disease Agency, more than a dozen countries are reporting confirmed cases. It says this is the first time such transmissions are recorded in Europe without known epidemiological links to West or Central Africa. So far, most infections have been in Europe, with some cases found in Australia and North America. Monkeypox is similar to smallpox, and its symptoms include fever, headaches, swelling of lymph nodes, and a rash. The disease spreads through very close contact with an infected person. It was first detected in the Democratic Republic of Congo almost 5 decades ago. Afghan health experts are sounding the alarm over the deteriorating healthcare system in their country. They say Afghanistan will soon run out of medicine if urgent action is not taken. Rahmatullah Balban reports from Kabul.
Rights groups warn that people are dying from lack of medicines in Afghanistan. Afghan Medicine Services Union also says that medicine supplies in the country are running low, and that no medicine might be available to the patients within the next 2 months.
Afghanistan is facing an unprecedented drug shortage and a sharp rise in drug prices. These days we are supplying drugs from our stocks and reserves, and I'm afraid they will run out of medicines within the next 2 months. The situation has hit our nation, health sector, and drug sellers.
The union blames the banking crisis, major cuts in global aid, and U.S. sanctions for the medicine shortage. It also called on the Taliban to allow traders to import medicine in any possible way.
Medicine shortage is rooted in different problems. Firstly, most world countries have stopped medicine export to Afghanistan since the Islamic Emirate is not recognized worldwide. Secondly, major amounts of drug importers' money is freezed and banks in New York are not cooperating. Thirdly, the Taliban have imposed certain restrictions on drug imports.
Patients in Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital in Kabul complain about their inability to provide medicines, calling for help from the international community to save their lives.
I am from the Jawzjan province. I have brought my child for treatment in this hospital in Kabul. I have been here for 5 days and I have spent all my money on services and medications. Some medicines are very hard to find and some very expensive. The doctor has given me this prescription and I am wondering how to provide the drugs.
This comes as Afghanistan is facing multiple outbreaks of diseases, including COVID-19, measles, and acute malnutrition. Afghan hospitals and clinics are running out of medicines. Doctors here say urgent action is needed to save the lives of patients. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Now we better understand why the terrorist cliques in the U.S. and in the Zionist entity desperately target and kill such inspirational figures of the Islamic Revolution as commander of the 41st Thar Allah Brigade during the liberation of Khorramshahr, Qasem Soleimani in January 2020 in Baghdad, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Beitul Muqaddas Operations Liberating Role Despite Terrorism. Stay tuned for more. 40 years ago, when Operation Beit al-Muqaddas triumphed in freeing the port city of Khorramshahr from the occupation of Saddam's tyrannical Ba'ath minority regime, there were shockwaves, not just in Baghdad, but also in Tel Aviv and Washington, because of the indomitable spirit of resistance of the Iranian people and the code name of their campaign, which referred to the Zionist usurped Islamic City. The triangle of evil, which until now was confident of slowly bleeding to death the Islamic Republic and turning the Iraqi-occupied parts of Iran into a sort of Palestinian territories or Kashmir that will never be resolved through any negotiations, began to hatch intricate plots in an attempt to avert the inevitable. Saudi Arabia, as the principal bankroller of Saddam's persecution of Iraq Shia Muslim majority and the ethno-sectarian war imposed on Iran, was also a bit shaken by the liberation of Khorramshahr. King Khalid bin Abdulaziz, the blinded bigot that he was, sent a congratulatory cable to Saddam that read, "Do not grieve at the loss of some 35,000 killed or captured mostly Iraqi Shia soldiers." The U.S. and the Zionist regime resorted to organized terrorism against Iran, including supply of internationally banned chemical weapons to Saddam and open support for the MKO hypocrites, whose ringleaders were soon shifted from France to Iraq due to fears that Iranian victories on the battlefields would end Ba'athist rule in Baghdad, thereby opening the path towards the Golan Heights and the borders of occupied Palestine, in view of the Islamic Republic's already strong ties with Syria and the people of Lebanon. The first step of the enemies in this regard was the targeted kidnapping by the pro-Israel Falangist militia in July 1982 of Ahmad Motawassalian, the commander of the Muhammad Rasulullah Brigade during the Beit al-Muqaddas operations that liberated Khorramshahr, who was serving as defense attaché at the Iranian embassy in Lebanon. Motawassalian and his three companions in the car bearing diplomatic plate, Charge d'affaires Sayed Mohsen Mousavi, embassy technician Taghi Rastegar Muqaddam, and journalist Kazem Akhavan, were transferred to the Zionist entity by their terrorist captors led by the now deceased Ili Hubeika and Samir Giga, recently elected to the Lebanese parliament, who is on record as saying the Iranian diplomats were murdered. Today, Saddam and his Ba'athist clique have long been cast into the dustbin of history. The MKO hypocrites have fled to Europe in disgrace, and Iraq is now part of the growing Islamic resistance movement, which has emerged as a solid chain stretching from Iran to the Levantine coast of the Mediterranean Sea. All this means that the epic liberation of Khorramshahr exactly 40 years ago, due to the national unity and religious solidarity of the Iranian people, in spite of their being constantly targeted by terrorists in Washington and Tel Aviv, is a firm indication that Operation Beit al-Muqaddas did not end on May 24, 1982, but is firmly on its way towards the city of Beit al-Muqaddas and the cherished goal of the liberation of Palestine. Now we better understand why the terrorist cliques in the U.S. and in the Zionist entity desperately target and kill such inspirational figures of the Islamic Revolution as commander of the 41st Thar Allah Brigade during the liberation of Khorramshahr, Qasem Soleimani, in January 2020 in Baghdad. The latest victim of this spate of terrorism is Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodayi of the IRGC division of the Defenders of the Holy Shrines, who attained martyrdom in Tehran on last Sunday, May 22nd, as a result of a cowardly attack by Zionist regime agents. Vengeance is part of the liberating spirit of the Beit al-Muqaddas operations, and God willing, we'll soon see the dastardly terrorists brought to justice, whether they live in the US or in any other place.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Another massacre in the U.S., 21 killed, including 19 children. This is the 8th mass shooting in the U.S. this year so far, and it's only the month of May. Why do mass shootings in the U.S. take place in the first place, more so than any other country in the world? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will take a look at why there is not a strong enough appetite or will from U.S. lawmakers, perhaps, either whether it's Republicans or Democrats, to put an end to this wave of violence, unless what's inscribed in the Second Amendment or the powerful NRA gun lobby are the main obstacles in reaching that. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us is David Swanson, who's the director of World Beyond War, who joins us from Charlottesville.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. So I'm going to start with a question from you, Gerald Horn, and ask you for a reaction to what has happened, because it's obviously very depressing and very shocking that this has happened yet again in the U.S.
It's horrible, it's terrible, but it's also predictable. It's predictable because, number one, the United States operates under an archaic and antiquated constitution from the 18th century, during the era of the acceleration of the invasion of European settlers who thought that they needed weapons in order to massacre Native Americans to take their land and to import more enslaved Africans and needing weapons to keep them in line. And as you suggested, there's a Second Amendment that tends to validate that. But since then, you have this point that the right-wing movement in this country has latched onto that, because the right-wing movement in this country says that there should be no change in the antiquated interpretation of the Second Amendment because it might be necessary at some point in the 21st century, for example, for their movement to overthrow a government that they don't approve of. And then this industry, the arms industry, is a very profitable industry. It has been described as perpetrating an iron river of weapons into Mexico, which has really been very helpful to certain kinds of drug cartels, for example. They're meeting in Houston, Texas, as I speak, and there are about 55,000 members of the National Rifle Association, which is one of the most powerful grassroots organizations in this country. And then I think that we should not distinguish the point that this movement is based upon a white supremacy, based upon this idea that those defined as white have a virtual and veritable divine right to rule over everyone else in this country. And I would also say that when you have a foreign policy of the United States, which privileges this war, which routinely is involved in massacres of people in Afghanistan over the past two or three decades, or in Iraq in recent years, and other sites too numerous to mention, that it leads to the cheapening of life. And that cheapening of life has now returned with a vengeance back to the United States of America.
So what do you think, David Swatson? You have different dynamics involved here, of which, due to lack of time, I'd like to see how you can put this into perspective for us. On the one hand, you have the lawmakers, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. It seems like Democrats are more pro-control of the situation in terms of gun control, for example, rather than Republicans. At the same time, you have what's been called the NRA, which, you know, like Gerald Horn said there, they're a powerful lobby group. What does that exactly mean? Can you put these things that are pulling against what should be the prevention of the loss of life?
Well, I agree with every word that Professor Horn said there. There are structural problems and there are cultural problems. There are nations on this planet with similar cultures that have fixed the problem to an extraordinary extent structurally by banning guns. And the reason that this doesn't happen in Washington, D.C. is principally that they have legalized bribery and turned it into campaign contributions and made it perfectly acceptable so that politicians are openly bought and paid for. They also have this system of two parties in which, as on many issues, on this issue, one party, the Republicans, are openly and strongly against preventing gun proliferation, and the other party claims to be for doing something, but always manages to have a handful of its members against its supposed mission, even though it has the majority, and prioritizes keeping in place archaic rules like the filibuster that require it to have a supermajority that it doesn't have. And so it will use these tragedies as campaign material. Elect even more of us, and we'll do even more than the nothing that we've done so far, rather than taking action to do something about it. And you do have a culture that's been saturated with acceptance of violence. You have the U.S. government through, in this case, the U.S. Navy, funding programs in schools like the one attended by the latest shooter, to entice those who can't afford college, because college has outpriced many people in this country, to enter a program called ROTC, where they're trained to shoot guns. Very often, these shooters in high schools have been through these programs, have been trained by the U.S. government. In fact, the famous one in Florida was wearing the T-shirt from the junior ROTC when he shot up his classmates. And very disproportionately, mass shooters across the United States are veterans of the U.S. military, of U.S. wars. And so there is a culture of violence at home and abroad that creates these vicious cycles. It's a society saturated in both violence and guns. And unfortunately, we don't have a political system that seems capable of dealing with it unless we see a mass uprising of nonviolent action. And of course, the people of the United States are the least likely people in the world to do such a thing.
Gerald Horn, when looking through and sifting through some of the points that could have been addressed in this program, one of the things that stood out is a tweet by this one particular person, which was pretty striking when I read it, and it said, in retrospect, Sandy Hook marked the end of the U.S. gun control debate. Once America decided killing children was bearable, it was over. Now, that itself is deep in the way that it impacted at least a point of view of such for me. But then when you take a look at what could be more, even more impactful would be when you have the use of guns and how it has killed politicians. Martin Luther King, for example, Kennedy, for example. And yet we're still looking at this being an issue in the U.S. So obviously there doesn't seem to be enough of an appetite, willpower, or initiative, or whatever you'd like to call it, for this to end. How can this be channeled in order to reach a solution?
Well, that is the question, is it not? But one has to say that when you have these formidable, profound issues in the United States of America, what has helped to change the calculus has been international pressure. That's the reason why slavery ended. That's the reason why U.S. apartheid, or Jim Crow as it has been called, began to retreat. That is why the United States was ultimately driven out of Vietnam in the 1970s, for example. And I dare say that because of the formidable nature of this so-called white American population, which unites across class lines, whether people want to acknowledge it or not, and is determined to hold on to power by any means necessary. Recall that it was only a few days ago that you had this racist massacre in Buffalo, New York, where 10 black people were killed at a store. The massacre perpetrator was motivated by this idea that the demographics of the United States are changing, that people not defined as white are becoming the majority, and he was determined to overturn that by his own crude action. And so we need more international pressure against the United States, not least because even those who consider themselves to be well-intentioned in the so-called white majority oftentimes have an inadequate analysis, which leads to inadequate prescriptions, which then leads us on this vicious cycle back to killing 10-year-old children in a classroom.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
NRA is going to be coming to Texas in a matter of days, from what we understand, David Swanson. You're going to have a number of politicians speaking there. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, we understand, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, and Donald Trump. One thing he did when he was in office was, based on some of the things I'm reading here, reversing an Obama-era policy that had to that was dealing with restricting gun purchases by people, and deemed by the Social Security Administration to be mentally unable to manage their affairs. He reversed that. So that's just a reflection of how even former U.S. president looked at the matter. Why is there such a divide when it comes to U.S. politicians or lawmakers, I should say?
You know, when you started to mention a tweet, I thought you might be going toward a recent tweet prior to this latest massacre by the governor of Texas, pushing people in Texas to buy more guns because they were shamefully in second place behind California. There's a culture of love for guns. It's not a necessary evil. They're celebrated. The more guns, the better. And it's a cultural identity, a partisan political identity. In the hour before we were speaking, saw that same Texas governor have a press conference interrupted by the the Democrat who had run for governor against him, demanding that something be done about guns. This, a complete, almost worthless, sellout corporate moderate Democrat candidate, but even he willing to say something about guns, at least until he can get himself into office. You have a congressional race, a Democratic primary happening right now, the votes being counted in Texas, between a Democrat who's, you know, worthless on most issues but willing to take a stand on guns, and the incumbent Democrat who's absolutely against doing anything about guns, and you have the Democratic leadership in Washington, D.C., doing everything they can to keep that incumbent in office, even while claiming that they are the ones against guns. And so you have this endless hypocritical compromising from the Democrats, and this cultural celebration of guns as a wonderful, heroic things. If you don't have weapons of war in your house, the government is going to come get you. You know, this government that can't tie its own shoes. And so there is a cultural divide, and there is, a political logjam.
Yeah, and some of the stats that I'm looking at, David Swanson, which points to the question that I want to ask you, I'm sorry, Gerald Horn, is the fact that, so you have these massacres, 8 of them so far, by the way, and it's only May, as I mentioned in the intro. People are dying from gun violence on a daily basis in the U.S., daily basis. Now, this particular source talks about 45,000, somewhat, maybe 45,800 injuries that include deaths. But it doesn't get into the complete number. It says 2020 is the furthest of this database that they have. But anyways, if it is such an issue, which it is, this gun culture and how guns lead to deaths and people are using it to kill each other, why isn't it highlighted more throughout the media in the U.S. on a weekly basis, I don't know, on news channels, or more education perhaps on it in schools, et cetera? Is that happening and still not working?
It is happening to a degree. It needs to happen more, but I have to repeat what I said a moment or two ago. The ultimate problem is the fact that this gun culture comes from the bloody history of the United States of America, the history of a European invasion, where the people who were not only rich, but the people who were poor and were settlers and defined as white, were armed so that they could kill Native Americans. I'm sitting here in Texas. 200 years ago, this land was teeming with indigenous populations, particularly the Comanches. They've all been liquidated, exterminated. And so that helped to create this culture. And then, as I said before, you have to keep the black population in line, which is still happening to this very day. Many of our liberal friends buy into the mythology about the Constitution and the so-called sacred founding of the United States in 1776, which prevents them from dealing and grappling honestly with this bloody history. Instead, they blame political parties, which of course are ultimately dependent upon this same majority white electorate, which I've just excoriated. And so until we are able to deal honestly with this history, we will be continually
let's go with that line. Let's go with that line that you're talking about. Dave Swanson, last question. God forbid that any type of social crisis, which the U.S. is teetering on, breaks out in terms of a civil unrest of a massive scale, large in numbers in the U.S., where you have guns almost outnumbering the people. Isn't the U.S. government worried about something like that happening? 30 seconds.
I don't think there's a grave danger of that happening. I do think there is a grave danger of these shootings continuing and multiplying and of the continuation of nothing being done in Washington, D.C. But in terms of a violent uprising in the United States, I don't think it's much more likely than a nonviolent one, which is what we actually need, but is extremely unlikely due to the disempowerment in people's own minds.
Thank you, David Swanson, Director of the World Beyond War at Charlottesville. Gerald Horn, thank you, Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston from Houston, Texas. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tagwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality, and I am your host, Zainab Askari. In this program, we do a roundtable discussion on the very interesting topics. And today also, we're going to discuss one of the very interesting topics with two of the very special guests. I have with me Siddique on my left side and Fatima on my right side. I would want you guys to introduce yourself. Let's start from Fatima.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. My name is Fatima Peabody. I'm from Southern California, U.S. I've been here in Qom this time a little over 5 years. I studied a little bit at Jamatul Zahra Hawza. Since then, I'm just teaching a little bit of English conversation classes here and there and just attending lectures and my own kind of self-study, enjoying the Qom life.
Well, thank you, Fatima. Nice to meet you. How are you, Siddique? Let's know something about you, too.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Siddique. I am from the UK, specifically London. And I've been in Qom as well for around 5 to 6 years now. And I study in Bint al-Huda. My field of specialization is fiqh and usul, which basically deals with jurisprudence, the nitty-gritty of how the rules are derived.
True. So nice to meet both of you.
Thank you.
Depression, sadness, not being well. Don't you think that has become a part of life today? To be sad, to feel heavy, to feel depressed. I would like to start from Siddique.
Yes, so feeling sad, a person goes through fluctuations in their life. So there may be times when they temporarily feel sad, and that's just normal, right? We're human beings with huge emotions, and we need to learn how to control those emotions. But for a person to feel this continuously, it's not very safe for their physical health or for their mental health. So if you're feeling sad and depressed constantly and you don't feel a way out, first suggestion is, you see, there might be many reasons why people feel sad, especially some women might go through a phase like postpartum depression. After they have had a child, they go through a phase of depression. Or some people might have had, you know, loss in the family, grief, extreme stress, and they go through bouts of depression. First, please consult your doctors, right? Your doctor is the best person to advise you how to get through it. Going for counseling, going for counseling does not make you a weak person.
Mm-hmm.
All it allows you is to express your emotions and then learn how to handle them.
True.
To get to the root cause of your depression, your anxiety. And that allows you to, once your mental health is sorted, your physical health will start to improve. So that's for the first. Islam has a few advice on how to get through depression, how to get through. The first thing is, know that the mercy of Allah is always there.
Wow.
When a person is going through depression, they forget this, right? They forget that God is there. They forget that Allah's mercy is there. Because all around them, they feel everyone's being unfair to them.
True.
So they start to project this on Allah. But you can't project a human being's feelings to Allah. Allah is Allah. yeah. right? Allah will always be merciful. And the way He introduces Himself at the start of every surah, Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim. He could have said any, He could have used any of His other attributes, but He chose Ar-Rahman and Ar-Rahim. And we know one of them is for
having
everyone.
So many thousands of attributes, He chose
only these two. At the start of every surah, the mercy merciful. Is always there. It's us having to just sort of take a few steps to connect with that mercy, mm-hmm. you know? It's not always easy. Believe me, I have been through very long years of anxiety and depression. But you have to just understand that Allah is there, whether you like it or not. He's going to be there and He's waiting there, ready to give you His mercy.
Call upon me and I'll
Call upon
respond.
Me and I will answer you. And if you do not call upon me, you are of the ignorant, arrogant ones.
True.
Allah is telling you, call upon me, I'm there for you. That's one. Another verse.
And not everyone tells you that. You know, not everyone is there. Maybe people say that, but they are not there. But Allah is the one who's actually there all the time, in all your darks and in all your good times.
Every time. Another point is that I had Allah bi dhikr Allah tatma'innul qulub. Surely in the dhikr of Allah, in the remembrance of Allah, do hearts find rest. Now, when a person is going through anxiety and depression, sometimes that stage of sitting with the tasbih is very difficult because of feeling very, very spiritually low. It's okay to feel spiritually low. It doesn't define you as a person at that stage. You are definitely going through a mental health issue. Do not allow your spiritual state at this point to define you.
Mm-hmm.
But what you can do is just have a conversation with Allah. You don't have to sit and cry. Just have a conversation as you would with your best friend. What got me through my worst times was tawassul to Imam Mahdi.
Wow. You did tawassul to the Imam of your time.
Yes, to the Imam of the time. And there's a 2-rakat prayer that is there, even if you recite any 2 units of prayers, and just have a conversation. Other people have different methods. I had my methods. So in the remembrance of Allah, do hearts find rest. However you want to connect to Allah, connect. It's okay. It's okay to feel low. It's okay, but it's not okay to allow it to overcome your life.
Yeah.
And then a third point, and I won't go too much because it would take up too much time. And this is something that I read. I'm not going to say there are a lot of studies. There are a few studies that have been conducted on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cedar leaves. I think in English it's called jujube. So jujube leaves are, if you take water with jujube leaves and wash it over your head or put it over your head, it starts to calm a person down.
Mm-hmm.
Some recommend having this type of tea. It aids in relaxation. Again, consult with your doctors, but these are a few, very, very, very few.
All right. Points. These are very few methods to
there
overcome
are quite a
depression.
Few.
Right.
The books of du'as are filled with
how
du'as.
To overcome that. Yeah.
Yeah, on how to overcome.
Well, we'll continue the discussion. I'll talk to Fatima as well, but here we need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. And we are discussing about sadness, feeling heavy, or being depressed. Fatima, have you ever felt depressed or very sad or like very heavy, like I'm done with this now?
I think everybody goes through that sometimes, some people more severe than others. And I think it seems, I mean, I know the brothers, men also go through it in different ways, but I think for women, I know more, we go through different hormonal changes, especially after 40. And as she said, maybe the postpartum depression and just different things, or those who have gone through divorce is very traumatic, and just different hardships in life, it can make you feel like very sad and depressed. But I think there's a difference obviously between feeling sad and depressed sometimes versus all the time. And you know, you really need to, I think,
as she said, definitely consult a counselor. And I think there's a lot of issues in these cultures, definitely here in the culture here. I've talked to so many Iranian sisters here. I'm friends with them and trying to understand the culture here because I was raised kind of like a mixed up culture. True. So I'm always trying to learn more so I don't offend people and like just to understand my environment here. And it's really, really a lot of the families here, unfortunately, even up till now is kind of the old way in the U.S. It's kind of in the past, they kind of thought more like that. Nowadays in the U.S., most of the people are going for counseling, getting therapy. It's like it doesn't make you weaker or like you're really mentally sick. Counseling can just help anybody. I think most people definitely can benefit from it no matter what, even if they're not feeling sad. It can help you in the self-improvement, self-building, you know. So I think that's a thing to consult with the counselor if you're really, really feeling that. And then also, of course, all of the du'as, all of the thing. And I love this. I don't know much about it still, but I love this tip, Bisunatiya Islami. I know it's like such a vast thing. There's so many different herbal remedies and the Islamic medicine,
mm-hmm.
Different from the Western homeopathy herbal thing. And in the California, everybody's crazy for the Chinese medicine. I think it's also different from that. So I love these things, these natural things. If you're in the West with the Chinese medicine thing,
natural.
And over here the traditional Islamic, you can consult some of these doctors. It should be a real qualified traditional Islamic medicine doctor and looking into these natural remedies and just the du'as and the, you know, I think visiting the ziyarat helps. I mean, after I went to I've been twice, alhamdulillah, to Iraq, just connecting there because I hadn't gone ever. Going there and just connecting with Imam Hussein al-Islam.
Isn't that
nothing
miraculous?
Else like this helped
Isn't
me.
That
yeah,
miraculous?
This helped me. Like I was so much worse before I went there compared to after. So that really helps with the connecting with Ahlul
Bayt.
As if
you get some new
Imam
life.
Zaman al-Islam for sure. I think all these things help. And then I think definitely having a very healthy diet, exercising. I know a lot more. I was happy to see a lot more sisters, it seems like, are going to the gym regularly that maybe wouldn't have before, you know, or even just exercising at home if you can, taking walks, you know, taking care of your physical body, eating well, healthy, exercising. You know, I think if you're blessed with a compatible, good marriage situation, all of these things, you know,
true.
I think it really helps out. Yeah. Yeah.
They do play an important part. Well, we talked about that everyone is sad or sometimes feels heavy and feels depressed. And there are different ways like Siddiqa very beautifully explained the Islamic ways. And you too.
Sorry, and I forgot to say last thing, having good friends. I think everyone needs a circle of good friends.
Yeah,
that really helps. Yeah.
Having a circle of good friends as well. Having a circle of good friends and we need to have someone in the family as well. Don't you think like there are certain diseases that women go through, like you said, Fatima, that there are hormonal changes that women go through and men need to be aware of that? I mean, we have premenstrual syndrome, we have PMS, about which hardly men know. Don't you think there should be some awareness about this that guys relax if the woman is not feeling nice right now, she's just going through some kind of, she's not acting normal, there might be some changes in her body. Don't you think men need to play a role over here? Then friends, like friends come afterwards, obviously, but there are some people in the family who need to understand that there might be some hormonal issues with the body, who need to know her body.
So alhamdulillah, my husband was blessed with a very good teacher who actually told them once in one of their classes, is like, look, women go through this state, it's very difficult on them, be kind to them at home.
Yes.
If your husband's not been told, he's not been raised awareness, marriage is such a beautiful relationship. It's you know, it's a very close relationship between two individuals. If we can talk to our partners, like before, I used to warn my husband a week in advance. I'm like, look, they're going to start. You know, just chill
out.
Usually
they know after a few years. Okay, it's coming.
Yeah. So they just chill out. You know, I'm going to feel really upset. But if we create that conversation and if we create an environment at home where we can understand the opposite person, we can understand our partner, because men have their own stages in life where they go through bad times. But if we're there to support each other rather than a me versus you,
yeah,
it's
like
me
you said,
with you.
Yeah.
Right? So if we create the environment
supporting
in the house.
That's so nice. You know, she said me versus you should be avoided and me with you should actually be, you know, encouraged. That was so nice.
Yeah, I think that especially those that are that want to get married and they don't know as much, they should definitely, their elders and different